Welcome to this third episode of the Drinks Adventures podcast. I'm James Atkinson, and this week I'm going to be talking to Janice McDonald, who is chief winemaker at Birch Family Wines in Western Australia. But she's done a lot more than that, as you'll soon hear. I interviewed Janice just a few weeks ago in Sydney, and I'd actually intended to drop this episode a bit later in the season, but you have to adapt to the news, and only a week or two after our interview, Janice was crowned Gourmet Traveller Wine Magazine's 2018 Winemaker of the Year. That was a complete coincidence, but it made our chat all the more timely, so I wanted to share it as soon as possible. Now, at Birch Family Wines, Janice oversees the Howard Park and Mad Fish wine brands, using grapes sourced from vineyards in the Margaret River, Mount Barker and Great Southern regions. Prior to that, she ran her own Margaret River wine label, Stella Bella, to great acclaim, together with her partner, Stuart Pym. But we're not just talking about wine today, because Janice has been making beer for just as long as she's been making wine. She worked as a brewer at Australia's original craft brewing company, Matilda Bay, in the 1980s, and then at Little Creatures in 2000, its first year of operation. And she still brews today. If you've ever visited the Settlers Tavern in Margaret River Town and had one of the beers under the Margaret River Ale Company label, that's Janice's handiwork too. It's a longer chat today, so I hope you find it as interesting as I did. And if you stay till the end, I'll be giving away a prize personally selected by Janice from the Howard Park range. Well, Janice McDonald, thanks so much for joining me on the Drinks Adventures podcast.
I think it's a pleasure, James.
We'll soon find out. Look, to start off with, you studied winemaking at Riverina College in Wagga, but it wasn't too long before you took up a job as a brewer. How did that all transpire?
Well, it probably all comes down to a chance meeting that I had with Philip Sexton at Riverina College in Wagga. So Philip had come across as a wine student. So, you know, I guess the wine sort of industry had sort of excited him, and so he'd come to Wagga to study winemaking. He was a master brewer when he came to Wagga, but was forced by the college to then go and do an entry-level chemistry class. And I was earning a few more dollars as a student, and I was the demonstrator in the chemistry class. So I actually met Philip in Chem 1A at Wagga, and he knew much more about chemistry than I did. So after that, we spent a bit of time together whilst he was over at residential schools, and he said, if you come to WA, then come and see me, drop in and say hello. At that time, he was brewing at the Swan Brewery. So eventually I did go to Margaret River, or I did go to Western Australia, and it wasn't to sort of catch up with Phil. It really came down to sort of, the classes that you do for sort of organoleptic assessment when you're a student and, you're learning about wine. And, we came across Cabernet, and, Cabernet was one of those varieties that I struggled to sort of get the sort of this is what it's meant to be like and this is what it tastes like. So I didn't actually sort of get the two to connect until I tasted Margaret River Cabernet. And then when I tasted Margaret River Cabernet, I thought, wow, this is what Cabernet, this is what they say Cabernet is like. It actually really is like this. And so I basically got in my car and drove across the country.
But you drove across the country and became a brewer, not a winemaker at the time.
Well, no. I initially, before I actually drove across the country, I'd sort of sent a lot of letters to wineries in Western Australia and particularly Margaret River. To apply for jobs or see if there are any jobs. And to that effort, I had no response at all. So then I thought, I'll just go over there and have a look and see what it's like. So I really, I went across there without any job. And I didn't get a job. So then I returned to New South Wales and ended up doing some work for some friends that I had down near Geelong at Mount Duneed. And a few months passed, and then ultimately a job came up at Bass Felix, and I applied for the job. It was an assistant winemaking job, and I got the job. So I didn't, I knew what I was getting myself into as far as the Margaret River region, so accepted the job and came back to Western Australia.
So how long did you work at Bass Felix for before you moved to Matilda Bay?
I did the vintage in 85 at Bass Felix. But prior to actually starting that job, Philip had contacted me and said, I've got this job in brewing in Perth. Do you think you'd want to come across and do it? And I did think about it for a while. I didn't really know anything about brewing other than sort of how to drink beer. But it sounded interesting because it was the start of the whole sort of what I would call, you know, the first wave of craft brewing in Australia. But I said no at the time, and this was sort of in the very early days of Matilda Bay, just starting, because I thought, you know, spent 6 years studying wine, I really should try and pursue that career. So I did go to Vas Felix, and I did the vintage, so I was there for probably about 8 months. And so we're getting close to sort of the time of the America's Cup, a little bit before that, and Philip asked me again, and he said, "You sure you don't want to come to Perth and brew beer?" And the reason that I ran into Phil a little bit, so Phil had a group of friends in Perth, and he, because he's a very persuasive sort of character, he would invite them down to his vineyard, which was south of Margaret River and was ultimately to be called Devil's Lair, to help him pick rocks. I mean, what more would you want to do on a Saturday afternoon? And so I sort of had some connection with Philip while I was in Margaret River, hence the sort of him asking me again, was I interested in brewing? And being persuasive and me being interested in beer, I said yes. So I started to brew in Perth in 86, and that was sort of the lead-up time to the America's Cup, which was 87. And it was, you know, as I said, the first wave of craft brewing, and it was an incredible time. You know, we worked our butts off. We worked incredibly long hours, but it was a time of sort of intense learning.
So 1986, and you just touched on, you know, it was the very early days of the craft beer movement in Australia, to say the very least. I've heard Phil talk about those times and refer to them as the very dark years of brewing in Australia, the early 80s and obviously before that. What was it like from your perspective at the time?
Well, I mean, I suppose if you look at it from Philip's perspective, he'd come from, you know, brewing in a large company, sort of a large corporate brewer, making sort of, you know, ultimately in reality fairly generic beers. And his study in the UK, in Birmingham, obviously introduced him to a lot of different beer styles, which were really, you know, or unknown or unpopular in Australia. So, you know, it was part of that sort of, the campaign for real ale was happening in the UK when he was studying there. So he was sort of seeing all this evolve and happen around him. So, you know, the entrepreneur at heart, which, you know, he's certainly entrepreneurial, coming back to Australia and looking at the beer industry here, I think he probably saw that there was a niche to sort of, you know, take that style of beer and create it here. From my perspective, I was a beer drinker, but I didn't drink a lot of beer. And I guess my interest in beer was sort of, I guess, heightened when I saw the different beer styles that you can make. And he was the one who'd introduced me to that. So, you know, when we sort of finally put all the brewing equipment into Matilda Bay, he sort of gave me a brewing manual, the sort of, you know, the size of a couple of Bibles, and said, "Here, read this. Here's the equipment. If you've got any questions, I'm down at the Sail and Anchor." And obviously I was pretty young, pretty naive, I suppose, and I thought, well, that's fine. I'll just open the book and start at page one and away we go.
And you hadn't had any other exposure really to, the beer styles of the world really by that point?
No, not really. I mean, obviously I'd, you know, tasted a few beers, but I didn't have, an acute interest in beer particularly. I'd gone down the path of wine and sort of that was my real interest. But having seen, you know, what you could make and then sort of doing a lot of sort of, research into the different styles of beer and with Philip there saying, well, you know, we can pretty much do whatever we want, we read about beer, we looked at different recipes, we did a lot of trial brews, some worked, some didn't work. So it was sort of pretty much, yeah, do whatever you can. And the great thing about Philip and having spent the time that he spent in the UK, so he had a lot of access to the knowledge about hops, malts, so a lot of sort of different ideas and different ingredients that we could draw upon.
So it was a steep learning curve, obviously, for you, but did you fall in love with the craft of actually making beer to the same extent that you had making wine?
Yeah, I love making beer. The thing that I discovered over, you know, my time of making beer is that beer is exceedingly exact, and you have to be very exact with beer because it's ultimately, you know, next to milk, it's the, you know, it's the sort of the next most perishable product. So you can't hide behind beer. You have to get it right. And, you know, whatever style you choose to make and the balance that you want. Whereas with wine, you know, it is more robust. It's a little bit more bulletproof. If you want to make really high quality wine, there's not a lot to hide behind. But beer is a very transparent product, and you really do have to get it right from a flavour and balance point of view, but also from a microbiological point of view.
You've actually preempted a later question that I was going to ask. Brewing professor Charlie Bamforth says wine is easy to make than beer because wine guys get to throw their hands up and say, oh, it's the vintage. Brewers don't get to do that.
That is a very true statement.
What was it like in those early years being a female brewer?
In the early days of Matilda Bay, you were just a person. I mean, working for the likes of, you know, Philip and Gary Gazzetti, who was a partner in the company, there was no sort of, I didn't feel any sort of prejudices. I mean, also having worked and done vintages in the wine industry before that, and at that time, I think as a woman in the industry, you are determined to try harder to prove yourself. So you're incredibly determined. You'll do whatever just to show that you can do it. And I think sometimes you even try, you know, maybe way too hard, but you are determined. And if you have that sort of attitude, maybe that helps. So I couldn't say in the early days, and it wasn't until, the idea of the company being sold and us having a relationship with Carlton United Breweries, that I ever saw any sort of sexist behaviour.
And not asking specifically about that, but what was that era like going through that ownership change at Matilda Bay?
It was an enormous cultural change. At Matilda Bay, in the early days, it was very entrepreneurial. As I said earlier, if we wanted to make a different beer, we did. You know, we had the venues that we could sell that beer through. You know, if it was a reasonable sort of beer, I mean, beers like Dog Bolter, we didn't always get the alcohol exactly right every time. Sometimes it would be extremely high and sometimes it would be a bit lower. You know, sometimes our bitterness may have varied a bit. But, you know, the market seemed to be quite willing to try these new styles. When it came to sort of, you know, the large company sort of influence, should I say, then life got a bit more stringent. Sort of the specifications, you know, the brewing to certain levels of alcohol, hops, you know, it all came a whole lot tighter. And I can remember when at one time in the North Fremantle Brewery, and we were brewing, I think we were brewing VB for the first time, and we had to make the beer and send a keg over to Abbotsford so they could just do the taste test to make sure that it was close enough to the VB coming out of Abbotsford. And I thought to myself, no, I didn't get into this industry, and I've had so much fun in this industry up to date, to then start making beer to sort of absolute specifications and numbers that almost took some of the personality away from it. So, look, for someone else it would have been perfect, but for me it started to lose some of its creativity. And, you know, if you're aware of what happened in the early days of Matilda Bay, also with, you know, the likes of Redback and so on, there was an enormous amount of creativity, energy and hard work.
That consistency that you talk about, though, for any craft brewer that's looking to scale up and expand is a necessity as well, I would argue, if they're putting packaged beer out in a national market.
Oh, absolutely, it is. And, you know, you're asking me that question at a time and place. And, you know, in hindsight, I would be the first to say sort of the big company experience when it comes to sort of more rigidity in a production process is that you learn a lot from it. You learn how to be more specific. You learn how to be much tighter in your specifications to, you know, to brew better, even to make wine better. So it's that sort of corporate situation you learn an enormous amount from. So then if you can sort of have both parts of that, so you've had that sort of very free reign, sort of make anything, you know, make it so it tastes pretty good, but not so much hang their specs, but, you know, get it as close as you can. And then the rigidity of the large company, to be able to combine those two, ultimately, for me, I think it made me a more insightful brewer and a better brewer.
So what was your next move after Matilda Bay?
So after Matilda Bay, and I mean, I did stay for a while after the company had been purchased, but yeah, I, as I said earlier, it really wasn't for me. So Philip asked me, was I interested in going down to Margaret River and helping him set up the winery at Devil's Lair. But there was one small thing I had to do in between time, and that was to run a cafe in Perth. So that cafe was associated with a company called Dome Coffees. So Dome was one of the early roasters of coffee in WA, and had sort of bought into a business with a guy by the name of Phil May, who had a business called Western Roast. And Phil just roasted coffee and sold it around Perth. By him becoming involved in Dome and with people like Philip Sexton and Patria Jeffries, it put a shop front to it. So I was involved with a cafe in Perth called King Street Cafe, where we roasted coffee at the back and it was a cafe at the front. So I did that for a year before sort of the time came that I could actually go down to Devil's Lair and start building the winery and making the wines.
So how many years was it between then and when you ended up at Little Creatures in the head brewer role, I understand?
Well, the Little Creatures role came along. I mean, obviously I'd worked with Phil, I'd worked with Howard Cairns, Nick Trimboli in Matilda Bay days. So we sort of, you know, we knew one another. In 2000, sort of 2000, and I was at Devil's Lair, and again, having gone through another corporatisation with Devil's Lair being bought by South Corp, and again, back to that same story of the creativity of Devil's Lair and the sort of, you know, the quick decision-making. Then you go to the corporate sort of side of things, which tightens it all up, becomes more sort of systems-driven. Yeah, you're learning from both sides of those sorts of, those both sides of the industry again. But I thought, I don't really want to do this corporate thing again. And I knew that the whole sort of Little Creatures thing was bubbling along. And from a chance meeting with Philip and also with Howard, they said, you know, would you be interested? And I thought, yeah, I'd be interested in that.
Was there not a part of you that said, you know, haven't you guys learnt from the experience of Matilda Bay, which obviously didn't pan out exactly how they would have hoped?
Well, you know, we did go through the 97 recession with the Matilda Bay days, and I ultimately think sort of, you know, circumstances, you know, financially and, you know, probably had an impact on where that business could end. But particularly I think that Howard and Nick were keen to be able to make great craft beer at a reasonable scale, and it was very much driven by them. So I believed in their dream as well. I thought it's something that could be done.
By that point, had you experienced, you know, the beers of the world a bit more?
Oh, very much so. Yeah. I mean, I can't remember the exact year, but it must have been about 1988, I think. We had the opportunity. Oh, no, let me go back one step. Very kindly, in 1987, Philip asked me, was I interested in doing a brewing course in Berlin? And you could actually do a month-long brewing course at the Technical University in Berlin. So I was sent to Berlin to do this course, and yes, I was the only female in 24 brewers, and it was a brewing course for English-speaking brewers. So there were people from all over the world. There were Americans, there were Dutch, South Africans, you know, sort of all sorts of people were there. So during that period, because if you know Berlin, the bars don't close. There was a lot of exposure to sort of international and particularly European styles of beer. Yeah. So that was sort of really sort of, piqued my interest in beer particularly, and particularly sort of the finer beer styles. I mean, I love Pilsner styles. They are still my favourite beers. I love their exacting characters. So I had that experience. And then a little bit after that, through an arrangement with Stella Artois, we actually brewed Stella Artois in Australia for the first time at the Redback Hotel in North Melbourne, and I was the brewer there. So we had a Belgian brewmaster who spent about a week with us teaching us how to brew Stella Artois. So had a reasonable exposure to a lot of beer.
And you would have learned a lot about you know, just those European lager making techniques as well.
Absolutely, and loved that beer. Yeah.
Having been involved in both Matilda Bay and then Little Creatures, what was the vibe at Little Creatures when it launched, and the sense of the market potential for craft beer at that time?
So when I when I expressed interest in sort of the role at Little Creatures, I'm not exactly sure how it came about, but the end result was that Philip and Howard and I, we did a pub crawl of the US. And the reason that we did that was just to see what was happening in that sort of, you know, that American or North American market. And so, you know, we were in Los Angeles, we went up to Portland, we went over to Denver, we went to Chicago. It was just the funniest trip, but we were just tasting beer and looking at different beer styles. And I think, you know, underneath it all, it was sort of, you know, probably discussions that were had about what style of beer would be the Little Creatures' first beer. And obviously it is that North American pale ale style. And, you know, Philip had a lot of experience in that part of the world. So after he sold Devil's Lair, he then moved to North America and brewed beer in Oregon. So he was very familiar with that style. And then ultimately that was the style that Little Creatures decided to go with their first beer. Again, you know, I tasted, you know, I was a big fan of Sierra Nevada. I was a big fan of, what's the San Francisco beer called?
Anchor
beer. And we'd made sort of a style a bit like Anchor at Matilda Bay. So it was sort of, I guess, an evolution of that style and taking it on as a sort of a more sort of serious sort of, you know, sort of style for Little Creatures Pale Ale. So that was a hilarious trip. But in a sense, it was kind of in keeping with those guys. I mean, Howard's a fantastic marketer, incredibly entrepreneurial, and Philip obviously is. So to me it was, oh, well, here we go again. We're getting the band back together. What fun. And, you know, we're making it in an old crocodile park. What else? I knew that it would be a lot of work, but it's really not something that I've ever been afraid of. And it was very exciting. So it was sort of an opportunity to, yeah, I'd love to give it a go.
You were more interested in that than you were bringing Starbucks to Australia, which I believe was the other option that they looked at the time.
Thank God. I think this one's been way more successful.
Yeah. And so you were head brewer from day one, were you?
I was, because I was basically the only one there other than Aaron, who I'd convinced to come along with me. And it was the early days of building the brewery. So I was working with Roger Bussell, who was a consultant brewer to us. He'd worked at the Swan Brewery. And Roger Bailey, who is a brewing engineer, who'd also worked at the Swan Brewery. And these are older guys, but, you know, they'd been around the brewing industry for a long time and worked in different sites, different countries. And so they were sort of, you know, they were sort of the sort of big technical expertise that were engaged at Little Creatures to put all the equipment in. And then I was, I was involved from that beginning, but also then with all of the development of the, you know, all the trial brews and, you know, getting the style right.
And Aaron Heary of Gage Roads.
That's correct, yeah.
Who was working with you at Devil's Lair at the time when you brought him across with you to Little Creatures.
Yeah, Aaron might be able to tell the story better than I can, but yeah, he was a keen surfer, so, you know, he was hanging out in Margaret River surfing. And what else do you do in Margaret River if you want to surf? Well, you probably work in a vineyard or a winery and, you know, you turn up to work when the surf's not up, basically. It's changed a little bit from that today. And we discussed it, and I said, you know, I was going to Perth and we were going to set up this brewery, and he was interested. And so he came along sort of, you know, with no experience at all.
What was it that led you to leave Little Creatures? Was that to embark on your own venture of launching Stella Bella?
Well, before, when we started Stella Bella and the Suck Fizzle wines, my partner Stuart Pym and I, in 1997. So that was sort of pre-Little Creatures days. But Stuart was making those wines whilst he was at Voyager Estate and I was at Devil's Lair. And Stella Bella, our first Stella Bella release was in 1999. But it was a fledgling, very small business, and so really not able to sustain someone sort of with a full income. So this opportunity for little creatures came along. So I pretty much signed up for the first year. And my intention was always to go back to wine and to develop the Stella Bella business further, which is what I did. And so from those sort of, 2001 until 2010, it was really developing that business.
What was it like going back from beer to wine again, but also focusing on your own business?
I think when you're young and you start with something like that, there's probably a level of naivety. We thought if we could make great wine, we could put it in, an attractive, catchy package, then it would probably sell. And ultimately, really, at that time in the wine industry, it did. There was a lot less competition around. I mean, Stuart and I had come from backgrounds of having quite strong reputations in wine. You know, Stuart was a winemaker at Voyager Estate and been there for quite some time making lovely wines. You know, I'd come from Devil's Lair. So we had quite a strong reputation as good winemakers. So then putting wines out into the market, I guess we had a, pedigree might be stretching the word, but we certainly had a reputation and a history of making high-quality wine. And we also, I guess we did things in a slightly more quirky fashion than what was around at the time. I mean, naming a wine Suckfizzle, I mean, who would do that in their right mind? Coming up with a brand called Stella Bella, and then some of our wines were, probably after Brown Brothers, the first sort of Moscato in Australia. Our first red was a Sangiovese Cabernet blend. The Suckfizzle White was pretty much a sort of a Grave white copy. So, we were doing things which were probably a little, at the time, a little different.
And I noticed that your whole brand, the brand name, the brand livery, if you want to call it that, was Howard was involved in that, I believe, at Brain Cells.
Yeah, Howard was. Steve Boris was the graphic designer working at Brain Cells and was there from the early days of Brain Cells. And I had seen some of Steve's work in sort of other wine labels, and I was very keen to sort of have him involved. Yeah, so he came up with the Stella Bella brand design based on our brief.
So I guess fast forwarding like probably the next decade, and by this stage Stella Bella's had a lot of accolades for the quality of its wines, and you've ended up as chief winemaker at Howard Park. How did that? Maybe you can give us a potted history of how you ended up making that transition.
I'll do that. The GFC comes along at sort of 2008-09, and at that point, Stuart had actually moved to Stella Bella, and he was going to take over the sort of more day-to-day winemaking role, and I was going to sort of move into sort of a winemaking but a bit more marketing, even though I was doing a lot of that anyway. And then sort of the GFC came along and, we discussed it, between ourselves and thought, we've got a lot of eggs in one basket here. We don't really know what's going to happen in this industry. So maybe it was time to sort of make some changes. And we did that. So we decided to sell our interests in Stella Bella. And then Stuart stayed on there as the winemaker. But I thought, well, I'm probably the best person to make a move out of there. And so that's what we decided to do.
What was it that attracted you to work at Howard Park?
I didn't really know that much about Howard Park other than their wines. I mean, I knew the wines, and I knew the history of Howard Park. I'd seen Jeff at tastings around the place. He's very much a sort of a larger-than-life figure and, renowned for having a fantastic cellar. But the thing that I liked was the wines particularly. I thought that, the people that had made the wines there before me, such as, John Wade, Michael Kerrigan, they'd made some fantastic wines. And, from not only from Margaret River, but from the Great Southern. And I mean, John was making Rieslings out of the Great Southern in 1986 and some fantastic wines. So I was very attracted to sort of the diversity of wines from Howard Park and the opportunity to make wines from the Great Southern, because I'd only really, in the Western Australian context, I'd really only made wines from Margaret River. So it was a whole new sort of chapter sort of to, or a whole new venture, an adventure to sort of become involved in.
I mean, obviously Margaret River still a pretty young wine region at the time, and still is now. I mean, Great Southern, how did that compare at the time? This is sort of like going back to the frontier even more.
Yeah, I mean, I think even to this day, I mean, people, I think the Great Southern is a bit frontier, but it is because it's a much more sort of isolated area. You know, the population down there is obviously not as great as around Margaret River. You know, the wine industry infrastructure in the Great Southern is, you know, almost non-existent by comparison to Margaret River. So winemakers down there do an amazing job because their challenge is even greater. Their challenge is greater because of, you know, the lack of infrastructure. Also, you know, the climate, there's a lot less rainfall. You know, it's kind of wetter, colder at the wrong times of the year. So there's a much greater challenge, and you have to be very good to make very high quality wines out of the Great Southern. And there's some fantastic winemakers in that region. Look at the Rieslings coming out of there now, out of the Porongarups, out of Mount Barker. You know, the Pinots, it's the only place really in Western Australia that you can grow and make decent Pinot Noir. And we can do that. I mean, we've proven that. Robert Deletti has proven that at Castle Rock. And I'm sure, and I know that more Pinot and more of the sort of, you know, interesting clones, the French clones, have been planted in the Great Southern, particularly Mount Barker and Porongarup. And we will see more. And the Rieslings, well, yeah, I mean, they're fantastic. We have, I think you can get some very, very good Cabernet, but quite specific sites. We see that from Larry Cherubino. We see that in the Abercrombie Cabernet. So there's some very good old Cabernet sites, and they're planted to the old clones of Cabernet. Shiraz, well, again, that speaks for itself. Shiraz out of Franklin, but also Shiraz out of Mount Barker. So there's, yeah, and Chardonnay, the ubiquitous grape variety that that you can do a lot with in a lot of different climates, is fantastic. It's a completely different sort of structured wine to what you see from Margaret River. And then there's sparkling wine, which I think we do a reasonable job of as well.
What are the wines that excite you most from the Howard Park range to make?
I love making the sparkling wines because, in a sense, they're the greatest challenge for market acceptance. Because if you're making method traditional sparkling wine, you are up against, you know, sort of, you're up against champagne as the main contender, which, you know, has an enormous name and is the immediate go-to for anyone who's drinking sparkling wine. So to be able to make a high-quality sparkling wine that doesn't necessarily have to copy champagne, but, you know, you draw on that inspiration of champagne, but you can express your sight and your style and make very, very good wine. That's to me, the greatest challenge. And also, you know, champagne takes even longer for the result than table wine. So you've got to wait longer and longer to see, you know, the results of your efforts. Did it work? You know, was it the right blend? Was it the right sort of dosage? It all takes a long, long time, much longer than table wine.
You've obviously been drinking Margaret River wines for 30 years or more, and making them for almost as long, or probably as long. What are the main changes that you've seen in the region and in the wines in that time?
There's a lot more producers to begin with. I think the quality of Margaret River wine has been elevated. The competition is great to be able to achieve high quality wines. The vineyards are older. The vineyards have been planted with different clones. That makes a big difference. We've learnt a lot more about our sites and what they can do. There's so many things. And also, wine styles change over time. And that's another thing that I think has impacted on how we make our wines, specifically from a wine style point of view.
Is that about less oak treatment and all those kinds of things?
Yeah, I think it does tend to be. It does tend to be. You know, we've seen that sort of whole sort of Chardonnay sort of style being quite low, you know, sort of low oaked, no malo, quite lean, fine. You know, some people argue that it's probably gone a bit extreme, but it was, I guess, the complete sort of reaction and rejection to very big, rich, sort of over oaked, highly sort of maloed wines. I like to think there's a balance somewhere in the middle. You still want these wines to be sort of, you know, you can appreciate very fine wines, but you've also got to be able to drink them. So I think somewhere the balance lies in the middle, particularly with Chardonnay.
You are still making beer, which is at the Settlers in Margaret River.
That's right. In the industrial area, we have a small brewery, which is owned by the tavern. Yeah.
Tell me about that relationship and what it looks like today.
Okay, well, this little brew house, which is, it's quite good equipment. It's not particularly fancy, but it's serviceable and it works. And it originally started its life as a brewery called Bug Ocean. And I think the problem with Bug Ocean is that it really didn't have a fantastic route to market. So you could make all this wine, but where were you going to sell it? And a friend of a friend said to Rob and Karen, who are the proprietors of the tavern, well, you should speak to Janet. She used to brew beer. And, of course, you know, I knew these guys. And we basically got together in that way. Rob had some fairly specific ideas about what he wanted done. So he didn't want the beer filtered. He wanted it naturally carbonated. So the beers are not filtered. They're conditioned in kegs. And we wanted to keep it very natural and have our own style. And that's what we've pursued. It doesn't have all the bells and whistles in the brewery. So it is quite... It's quite a challenge, but I love a challenge to make high-quality beer with, you know, obviously not a lot of sort of invasive practices to get it exactly right. And it is a situation of, sometimes each of our beers can be a little bit different. And it almost takes me back to where I started from with beer.
When did that start at the Settlers?
2012.
Wow, so you've got 6 years of...
I know.
of moonlighting as a brewer on top of being a winemaker.
That's correct, yeah. But I still like, even though, as I say, even though our brewery is not particularly, you know, sort of sophisticated, I rather like the challenge of being able to produce what I think is a pretty good product out of some fairly, sort of fairly rudimentary equipment. That's the challenge of it. That's where your skills come through when, you know, you haven't got all the bells and whistles, but you can make something that's really quite good.
We've talked about how the Margaret River winemaking scene has changed in the last 30 or so years. If we talk about how the brewing scene has changed, that it's probably even more dramatic. What's your perception of that, being someone who's, living in the region, being a brewer and winemaker?
Well, I mean, when did this sort of second wave of craft brewing start? It started... I can't recall exactly when.
Well, probably people would say Little Creatures. 2000.
Yeah. So, you know, we were brewing, Matilda Bay was that first wave, and there were a number of breweries around the country at that time. So then 2001 rolls around and sort of Little Creatures start, and that probably did kick off the sort of, you know, the craft brewing industry in WA. I think an important thing that happened too was probably the availability of less expensive, you know, stainless steel and purpose-built small breweries. That was really important with the sort of proliferation of small breweries. So, you know, you could spend not an enormous amount of money and still put a small brewery together. We've seen, you would probably know better than I, James, how many small breweries there are in Margaret River. There's quite a number. But what I see and what doesn't actually appeal to me, because, you know, I'm a bit old, is... I'm a bit of a traditionalist when it comes to beer styles. I like the traditional style. So I like a fine, well-lagered pilsner. You know, I consider that American-style pale ale a classic style. I like English ales. I like stouts. But I don't actually like them kind of sort of... I don't like the hybrids that come through. I'm a bit of a purist. But I think we do see a lot more experimentation in beer and in craft brewing. And you do see quite a lot of that around Margaret River. But the people seem to be very much enjoying it. I think it has opened up craft brewing and craft brewing beer styles to a greater audience than has ever happened before. And that's a good thing.
What's next for you? I mean, you've been at Howe Park for, I think it must be the last 7 years or something like that. Yeah,
this will be my eighth.
We've looked back over your career, it's been a bit, this is your life. what's the next chapter?
I think I've got a few years of both brewing and winemaking left in me, but I'm keen to study horticulture. I'm keen to know more about other plants. And, the two things in my life, if I could be anything I wanted to be and I was young, my choices would be an alpine downhill ski racer, or a world-renowned planter of vertical gardens. So I can probably still pursue the idea of horticulture and vertical gardens. I think my career, potentially, as a downhill ski racer, is over.
What do you drink when you're not drinking your own wines or local beers?
I know, maybe I shouldn't say. I love drinking champagne, and/or sparkling wine. So I love method traditional wines. I love trying many different wines and trying to prize out of them what's happened there, what's been used, you know, how much sort of dosage, what's the acidity like, sort of what sort of expedition's been put into it. I love prizing things apart in that way. And my other absolute favourite, which is slightly cliched, is Cabernet. Just, again, beautiful Cabernet. I love beautiful Cabernet. Yeah.
And does that mean, French Cabernet or...?
Any Cabernet. Cabernet from anywhere in the world. But, yeah, prizing wines apart is something that I enjoy doing. And I meant that in a mental sort of intellectual way. You know, what has happened here? I probably taste more wine than I drink. You know, if I'm at home and Stuart's a winemaker and we sort of might go and taste, a particular variety, whatever it might be. It could be Nebbiolo, it could be anything, and then it's sort of, what if we then just had a look at this or that or something which is somehow related. So another Barolo, or let's compare Barolo to Barbaresco. So, you know, sometimes on the weekends we might open four or five wines, but we don't get to the bottom of the bottle, fortunately.
Well, just to wrap up, what's Howard Park recently launched that people can go out and find and try for themselves?
Well, we've got a couple of new wines coming through. So today, actually, or this month, we've launched a wine called Petit Jeté. So it's an additional sparkling wine to our Jeté range. So we have the Grand Jeté, which is our vintage wine. We have the non-vintage one. And then we have the Petit Jeté, which is a little bit more entry level. Has a little bit less time on lees, and we just made it a little bit softer and richer. So that's a new wine that we've put out. In addition, in 2016, we made a blend of Cabernet and Shiraz, and that wine is 80% Cabernet and 20% Shiraz, and that's from Margaret River. And that wine is named after Amy Birch's parents, or in fact their initials, which is ASW. Her parents, coincidentally, her mother and father both have the same initials. So that's a very exciting wine. We've used a little bit of American oak in that wine, which normally we don't. And later this year or early next year, we have a very high-end Cabernet, which comes off a very special block on our Leicester Vineyard that we will be releasing. So, they're all very exciting wines for us. In the vineyards, though, which will be sort of, new wines that will come out in a few more years, we've planted some Pinot Gris on our Mount Barrow Vineyard. We've also planted a bit of Gewurz Tremina. We've put in some new clones of Riesling. And then we've got a couple of other little things up our sleeves, some different red varieties that we're still propagating in the nursery.
Sounds like plenty to keep you busy for a great many years.
Yes, it certainly. But this is the nature of life at Howard Park. It's always very exciting. There's always something new happening. I think it's sort of just the nature of the beast.
Well, Janice, it's been a fantastic chat. Thanks so much for joining me.
Pleasure.
Now, thank you so much to everyone who has left reviews and ratings on iTunes and Stitcher so far. Congratulations to our week one and two winners. They know who they are, and I've put them on the show notes for episodes one and two on the drinksadventures.com.au website. We're not out of the woods yet, though. I still need reviews and ratings from as many of you as possible to convince the powers that be that this podcast is worth promoting so that more people can hear it. Now, as regular listeners would know, each week I'm giving away a prize for my favourite review. So drop everything and get writing now, and you really are in with a good chance of picking up something nice to drink. This week, the prize is one of Janet's favourite wines under the Howard Park label, the Metho Traditionnel Sparkling Wine Petit Jeté Non-Vintage, which won a gold medal at the 2018 Champagne and Sparkling Wine World Championships in London. Remember that if I can't identify you from your name when you post the comment, I have no way of getting in touch with you, so email me a screen grab to hello@drinksadventures.com.au so I have your details. That's hello@drinksadventures.com.au. That's all for today. I'll see you next week.